Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org. Good afternoon and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth of Club of California, the place where you're in the know. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the Commonwealth Club and the moderator for today. You can find the Commonwealth Club on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. And to further discuss Commonwealth Club programs, please visit the club's blog at commonwealthclub.blogspot.com. The Commonwealth Club thanks NATO for its assistance in making today's program possible. Today we're going to get an inside view of the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, its role, and its future. Now including 28 countries of Western, Eastern, and Southern Europe, as well as the United States, NATO has evolved to include roles as varied as fighting the Taliban in Afghanistan, airlifting aid to Haiti after the recent earthquake, and ensuring collaboration among its members in combating terrorism. To discuss the future of NATO and to answer your questions, it's my pleasure to introduce our distinguished panelists. To my immediate left is Ivo H. Dalder, the United States Permanent Representative to NATO. Ambassador Dalder was appointed by President Obama to his current post in May of 2009. He also served as Director for European Affairs on President Clinton's National Security Council staff from 1995 to 1997, where he was responsible for coordinating U.S. policy towards Bosnia. Prior to being appointed U.S. Ambassador to NATO, Ambassador Dalder was a senior fellow in foreign policy studies at the Brookings Institution, specializing in American foreign policy, European security and transatlantic relations, and national security affairs. Ambassador Dalder was educated at Oxford and Georgetown universities, receiving his PhD in political science from the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. To his left is Ambassador Stefano Stefanini, Italy's permanent representative to NATO, where he has served since 2007. He has also served as Deputy Chief of Mission at the Embassy of Italy in Washington. He entered the Senior Foreign Service in June of 2000 with the rank of Minister Plenipotentiary, having previously served as Deputy Diplomatic Advisor to the President of the Republic of Italy. In 1995, Mr. Stefanini was named Senior Political Counselor at the Italian Embassy in Washington with responsibility for political and military affairs. He followed U.S. foreign policy and specialized on the Balkans, European security and NATO, and U.S.-Russian relations. Prior to that, Ambassador Stefanini had been posted to Moscow as an economic and then political counselor. As an analyst, he has firsthand experience with the collapse of the Soviet Union and the Russian economic and political transition. He graduated cum laude in law from the University of Pisa. We have another Pisa University graduate here whom I happen to know. Per Poulsen Hansen is the permanent representative of Denmark to NATO, a post he's held since 2003, and he is also the dean of the Diplomatic Corps of Representatives to NATO. Previously, he served in the Prime Minister's office as Assistant Secretary of State and as Undersecretary at the Ministry of Foreign Affairs. From 1991 to 93, he was the Danish ambassador to Czechoslovakia, with later accreditation in the Czech Republic and the Slovak Republic. From 1987 to 91, Ambassador Poulsen Hansen was head of the Security Policy Department in Denmark's Ministry of Foreign Affairs. He also served at the Royal Danish Embassy in both London and Moscow. Ambassador Poulsen Hansen holds a Master's of Law and Arts degree and a Bachelor's degree in Russian, both from the University of Copenhagen. So please welcome our distinguished representatives. I'm going to start us out with a few questions that I hope will stimulate everyone else's thoughts, and then hopefully you and the audience will feel moved to ask questions of your own. And let's start with some recent news events that involve NATO. First, on the good news front, CNN reported today that the Afghan flag was raised over Marja. in Afghanistan, where there's been a major push by NATO forces. Are NATO forces making headway in Afghanistan? What does this particular event, the raising of the Afghan flag in Marjah, signify to you about the effort in Afghanistan?
Let me start off to thank you, Gloria, for having us here. Thank you all for having us here. It's rare for NATO to come to the West Coast. It's rare for NATO to come to the East Coast, even in the United States. But it's a good reminder that just because you're in the West Coast doesn't mean you're not in NATO, because you are. And it's great to be here. Marjah is an extremely important operation. It's, in some sense, it's a more important operation than what is happening physically on the ground. What's physically happening on the ground is that the Afghan government, supported by the International Security and Assistance Forces, primarily U.S., British, Danish, and other forces in the south, have retaken what was a major Taliban stronghold in the Helmand River Valley, which is an extraordinarily important part of the south, the major agricultural area in the south where the United States and USAID and other countries invested heavily in the 1950s to create a very good place, to agricultural place for local Afghans. Marjah was an area in which the Taliban had effectively created a safe area and a safe haven. That safe area is now gone. The Taliban has been defeated in that area militarily. The retaking of Marjah, the flag, the pulling up of the flag of the Afghan government, has reestablished formally the control of the Afghan government of this important region and this important city in central Helmand. That's the first step. There are many more steps to come. Now it is important for the Afghan government not only to have a flag, but to actually have control over the city of Marjah, and then out to the districts that surround it, so that most, and then ultimately all of Helmand can be taken control of by the Afghan government. And what does it mean to have control? It means first that the security is really safeguarded by Afghan police, and Afghan secondarily by Afghan army forces. These forces need to be trained. They need to be put into place. We're working very hard at NATO to do that. Second, it means that the government, the local government, is in control. The district governors and then the governor of Helmand actually can control what happens inside the city, provide services that are needed, from health care to education. And third, it means that the economic potential of this region is directed to the positive development for the Afghan people. This is one of the highest poppy-growing regions in the world. We want to encourage the Afghans to grow the kind of crops that that can feed them, rather than feed the needs of other people, usually outside of Afghanistan, in terms of opium. So we have a lot of we have a lot of efforts still to be done. But the first and most important instance is you create a situation where you clear, as we call it, the area from Afghan insurgents, in order to establish the possibility of Afghanistan to take a hold of itself. The fact that we have moved that quickly, with relatively, and all everything in war is relative, relatively few casualties, is a good first step.
Gentlemen?
To summarize, I think what Ambassador Dalder just said, so far so good, and now the hard work begins, because the hard work will be provide economic governance and economic development. This is a real test of the new strategy.
Well, the Danish contribution to the force in Afghanistan has been in Helmand now for years, in another district on the Helmand River Valley. And the operation, hopefully, and I believe it will be so, will have an impact on the whole area, in the sense that you show that you are in a position to clear an area, to hold it, hopefully with the greatest possible contribution from the Afghan security forces, and then to move into the build phase. And I agree with Ambassador Dalder that the operation has been a success in the clearing phase. Now we are moving into the holding phase and later into the building phase. And hopefully it will serve to spread the stability in the Helmand province, which unfortunately has been in focus, among other things, for the reason I mentioned that it's a very heavy poppy cultivating area, and an area also where there's been a very heavy infiltration by the Taliban. And where the problem has been that when the forces, for instance, the Danish battle group, has been able to clear an area and has withdrawn from the area, it has then been difficult to hold it, and you have seen a re-infiltration from the Taliban. Hopefully, the operation Marja will go through all the phases successfully.
Let's talk for a moment about the level of commitment in NATO and among the various NATO countries to the efforts in Afghanistan. In the last few days, the Dutch government has indicated that it will pull out its troops by beginning in August. Any comments on what has happened in the Netherlands? Is this a unique situation, unique to the Dutch political system? Are there any other countries in which the commitment to maintaining their contributions to the NATO forces in Afghanistan are in question?
Well, I think one way to look at the Dutch events is, in fact, in a larger context. For one, the Netherlands had announced, and the government had announced in 2007, it was going to pull out by August of 2010. That was a decision that was necessary for the government even to stay in Oeriskan province for that long. And the decision, the collapse of the government was the result of the fact that a majority of the cabinet wanted to revisit that decision. In some sense, what was happening in the Netherlands was a move away from pulling out as opposed to a confirmation from pulling out. But the political consensus didn't exist to make that decision. And that is part and parcel of something we have seen really since the early 2009 and in an accelerated fashion since December. In April of 2009, following the decision by the President of the United States to engage in a very serious way in a new strategy in Afghanistan, which was reaffirmed in December with the deployment of 30,000 more troops, we have seen from virtually every country that is participating in this operation an increased commitment to the effort in Afghanistan. Of the 43 countries that are participating in the International Security and Assistance Force, ISAF, 36 countries have decided to deploy more troops and provide more resources in the last three-plus months. Nearly 40,000 more troops are being deployed in 2010 as a result of a commitment by this alliance and by its partners to strategy that has now been decided by NATO, by the United States, with its NATO partners. And we're all in this together. And I think the fact is that the Netherlands understands that. That's why there was a political debate. That political debate will be ongoing as there are elections. Ultimately, the Dutch government will decide for itself how it is going to contribute. But the fact is that what we are seeing is a recommitment, a strong commitment, not only from the United States but from all our European allies to this very important effort.
I think you have to see that decision against two backgrounds. One is the political, the domestic political situation. That was a political commitment made by the government. But on the other hand, like Ivo said, against the background of a substantial increase by all others. Italy, for instance, we have responded to this surge with 1,000 men that will be deployed by July 2011. So in spite of, there's no doubt that in Europe there is an issue about the popularity of the war, like, and not only in Europe, I think. But against it, the commitment has increased substantially by all of us and has been consistent for a number of years now.
Well, just two points. We would have liked to see a continuation of the Dutch presence in Euroscan in one way or the other, and we still have that view. On the other hand, this is a sovereign and internal Dutch decision, which is linked to the political situation. And in that sense, of course, it is respected and should be respected by the alliance.
Question from the audience. I'm staying on Afghanistan for a moment. Would the guests please be so kind as to elaborate on their thoughts concerning the U.S.-NATO recent efforts to engage members of the Taliban in dialogue? Is the effort seen as successful?
I think we are at the very early stage, and this is where I think that the MADRA operation is particularly important, because it sent, especially if we are successful in the hold and build, because it sends a message to the Taliban that you can re-enter the political process. You know, when we talk about the Taliban as a galaxy, many are just people who oppose the government, have grievances, and if they see a working government in an area, and this is what we will try to do in MADRA, that they'll change the perception. Quite interestingly, General McChrystal, when we asked him what's happening to the Taliban, because many fled, are they moving to other areas? He said, we think that many of them will just go underground, but will stay because they're local. And this is why if they start re-entering the normal political life or just reintegrating, this does change the dynamics in Afghanistan.
Well, the headlines are reconciliation and reintegration. Reconciliation is the political process which must be led by the Afghans themselves, and measures are being taken to that effect, where NATO and the NATO force can come in a supporting role. The reintegration is exactly what Ambassador Stefanini says, to have the Taliban fighters who are often of local origin for a price of a few dollars fighting on the Taliban side, to realize that things are changing in the local environment, and they will then be included in the normal society. So these are the two paths which have to be pursued.
I just want to clarify one important issue. Neither NATO nor the United States is engaged in reconciliation negotiations with the Taliban or the insurgency. Any such conversation, if it is to take place, is taking place between the Afghan government and the insurgency. Neither NATO nor the U.S. has a direct role in it. In the reintegration part of trying to help figure out ways to get fighters back into their roles as productive members of society, as we put it, there may well be a role for the NATO forces, but there is none in the negotiations.
Very important clarification. Let me remind you, you're welcome to go to the mic and ask questions, as well as my working through the questions people have already submitted. Moving on to some other areas of current controversy, shall we say, involving NATO and NATO countries. The French recently announced their plans to sell the Mistral helicopter carrier to the Russians, I believe the first sale by a NATO country of major military weaponry to the Russians. Views on this, gentlemen?
Well, Secretary Gates addressed this when he was in Paris. He expressed his and our concern about the sale, in particular in terms of the perception of some of our allies. And some of our allies have clearly expressed their view that this is worrisome from their perspective, and that is an issue that the French government ought to take into account. Of course, every government is and every nation has its own rules and its own rights to sell whatever it is that they want to sell. The United States sells armaments to a variety of countries. We wouldn't want NATO to tell us who we can and cannot sell it to. So let's be clear, the French are within their own legal rights to do this. But it is clear that there are a number of nations in NATO that have expressed concern about selling a helicopter carrying ship like this to Russia.
Ivo, since I know you're very well versed in military technology, could you explain to us what the capabilities of this carrier are and what type of capability will it provide to the Russians?
It really is a very small carrier. It cannot support the takeoff and landing of normal aircraft. In that sense, it's not an aircraft carrier. It's a helicopter carrier. So it has the capacity for deployment of, I believe, 24 helicopters, which could be used with the right equipment for assaults on land from water. Waters, whether it's in, look at the geography of where Russia is, whether it's the Black Sea or the Baltic or other places. It could also be used for search and rescue in the high north, where we will increasingly find commercial and other shipping as the ice recedes. So there's a variety of legitimate reasons. And in fact, defensive measures are also legitimate. Let me be clear on that. There are a variety of reasons why this may well be a useful platform for the Russians to possess. At the same time, it is the kind of capability and it is a kind of step that some of our allies find worrisome.
One last question along those lines. Does it give the Russians significant incremental military capability beyond what they are able to front for themselves? Is it strategically significant in that sense?
Even at four ships, the answer to that ought to be no. That is to say, it is a small increase in military capability, and the issue is less the actual capability that is being acquired by the Russians, but the perception that the sale engenders.
What I'd like to say is that, without adding anything, what Ambassador Dolder has just said, in the end, it comes down to what is your perception of the relationship with Russia. If, as we're striving to build a partnership with Russia, the sale of tactical means to Russia that, as you said, do not change the balance of power, should not be a matter of a radical concern.
Ambassador Paulsen Hansen?
I don't think I have anything to add to what has been said already on this issue.
And that does raise an important issue, which is, what is the relationship between NATO and Russia? Are we headed towards a closer relationship between Russia and NATO, in which such a move would not be significant, which in fact might drive the relationship in this closer direction? So we'll get back to that in a little bit. I see some questioners at the mic. Sir?
Thank you, Dr. Duffy and ambassadors. My name's Peter Tisella. I'm a military Vietnam-era veteran. I have two grand long-term strategic questions, and hopefully you can take them back to NATO. The first has to do with the exit strategy from Afghanistan. About 9 months ago, I communicated to General Petraeus, who was here in San Francisco, the concept of training Pakistani troops in Afghanistan. And it seems to me that, like NATO and the alliance that developed there, there needs to be an alliance between Pakistan and Afghanistan, both on a political government level, but also on a military alliance. And that's the way to get out of Afghanistan, is when they have their own alliance. So my question is, along this question, is can NATO and the countries it represents encourage Pakistan to follow this dialogue and encourage Afghanistan to invite some Pakistani troops in to be trained by NATO in counterterrorism, and then possibly work with Afghani troops in developing a cohesion between them? My second question...
You know what? Let's take that one first, because that's a sufficiently complex question. Gentlemen?
Well,
Ambassador Paulsen Hansen.
Exactly, the training area and the training efforts are very much in focus. apart from the return to the Pakistan issue, but the establishment of a NATO training mission is, although it's not said that explicitly, of course, linked to the possible exit at one stage and at least to the transition from NATO authority to the local Afghan authority, as was also mentioned in connection with the operation in the Helmand province. And I think we all see the training area as an extremely essential part of the operation, and many efforts are being made. The training mission is being expanded. There is a trust fund established. There are donations of equipment also for the Afghan army. When it comes to Pakistan, NATO encourages as many contacts as possible between the Afghans and the Pakistani. At the military level, there is a tripartite commission with participation also from the NATO side. There are different border contacts also. And NATO has increased its direct contacts with the Pakistanis, both at the military level and the civilian level. Of course, it's no secret that NATO is seen as a foreign entity in that part of the world. We believe that the assistance which was given by NATO in the wake of the earthquake in Pakistan had a good effect. And we have also at the council level in Brussels had several contacts directly with our Pakistani colleagues. So it's certainly an area which is being given high priority, and the efforts of the Pakistanis to make a kind of a cleanup of the relevant areas in Pakistan, of course, are followed and supported also by the alliance.
Maybe we'll let someone else have a different question here.
Both Ukraine and Georgia are relatively unstable, some would say very volatile polities. The outgoing Ukrainian president recently declared a man named Stepan Bandera, who is widely regarded in Poland and Russia as a Nazi collaborator, to be a Ukrainian national hero. President Saakashvili of Georgia shelled 2,000 civilians prior to the Russian intervention in South Ossetia. My question would be for the American ambassador, if we do extend NATO membership to Ukraine and Georgia, what are the potential costs to the American taxpayer and to the American soldiers and the relative risks in being drawn into conflict between either Georgia and Ukraine and Russia? And if NATO membership is such a wonderful thing, how is it that since 1945, Finland, Sweden, and Austria all seem to have done very well and have prospered without it?
Very fair question. We're not at anywhere near the point at which Ukraine or Georgia is a member of NATO. Let's be very clear. The process by which countries become members of NATO is a lengthy one. It requires a continuing level of reform on the political and military, as well as on the economic level, in order to meet the criteria for membership, which neither Ukraine nor Georgia at the moment meet. Ukraine has just gone through an election, and one of the most important requirements for membership is actually wanting to be a member. We will have to see whether under the new government that will continue to be the case. It certainly was under the previous government, but with the new president it may in fact no longer be the case. This is a decision that the Ukraine and Georgia will have to make in the first instance by themselves. Importantly, it's a decision they make. It is not a decision that any country can veto. It is a decision on the part of the 28 NATO members whether the time is right to invite those countries to become members. There is no consensus within NATO. In fact, I don't think there's a single country within NATO at the moment that believes that either Ukraine or Georgia have met the requirements of membership. So it is premature to have a whole discussion about what the costs of such a decision, which may or may not happen in the future, is going to be. We want to encourage Ukraine, and we want to encourage Georgia to take the steps that are necessary for it to meet the criteria for membership, and if they would like to, particularly if they would like to become members. That's a process in which we will assist them. We will do so bilaterally, and we will do so through a variety of programs NATO has. But ultimately, it is up to each of those two countries to undertake the reforms that are necessary for NATO to consider an invitation to membership.
Let me say something that might surprise a little view coming from Italy, which certainly belongs to within the North Atlantic Council, to what I would call the Russia fan club. But I want to emphasize because how we keep the two issues separate. And this is, I've thought myself several times about Finland, Austria, Sweden, as compared to the situation of Ukraine and Georgia. Sweden, Austria, Finland, Switzerland are neutral countries. Some of the namely, especially Austria and Finland, had to be, could not be part of NATO. That was part of the Cold War conflict, but had never any doubt of being European and Western countries. Countries like Ukraine and Georgia, who are making decisions to be democratic, and wanting to be European, they are struggling for an identity. The belonging to clubs like the EU or NATO is fundamental, or the prospect of being part of that group of countries. And I can assure you, as much as we discuss among ourselves about the differences between, with the distinction or differences between NATO and the EU, when you're out of the tent, we belong to the same package. For them, it is fundamental. They have to believe that road is open to them, be it EU, be it NATO, be it both, because that provides them a guidance, a reassurance, and an identity.
Let me ask a basic question that someone has submitted. How many NATO troops are deployed around the world? When a NATO member becomes involved in an armed conflict, is it always in its role as a NATO member?
The total number of armed troops, it changes every day, but it's around 150,000 troops are deployed on NATO operations abroad, the most important of which are, of course, in Afghanistan, where the United States is in the process of making a major shift of moving the forces. Virtually every soldier and airman and marine inside Afghanistan is moving into NATO. It used to be as a separate U.S.-led operation, which is expanding the number of NATO soldiers. We have a major operation in Kosovo with 10,000 soldiers. We have a NATO operation in the Gulf of Aden as part of our counter-piracy operations. We have a NATO battle group, naval battle group that is either doing counter-piracy or other work. We have a NATO mission in Iraq, a training mission in Iraq. So if you all add that up, you get to about 150,000, though the vast bulk of those are, of course, in Afghanistan. In order to be involved in a NATO operation, NATO needs to approve the operation, which means that the 28 nations, which work, it's an organization that works on consensus, will have to approve the operation. And any soldier that is part of that operation will be there as a NATO member. But, of course, every country will maintain its right to use its armed forces without necessarily having to rely on NATO. Most countries in NATO will do it either as part of a NATO or an EU or UN operation, but every country has the right to deploy its forces as a national asset, and some, like the United States, often do.
Gentlemen, any comments?
No, just to stress that the NATO has become like a linchpin of all major peacekeeping and stabilization operations, be it NATO, of course, but also UN and EU, in the sense that you will hardly find any operation in the world now which would not have the participation of a NATO country, which makes it extremely important for all other countries to establish the capacity of operating with NATO, what we call interoperability.
Let me mention for our participants not here in San Francisco, this is the program of the Commonwealth Club of California, and we're speaking with three ambassadors to NATO about the future and roles and missions of the NATO alliance. Question.
Since you're in California and the Western United States, and you were on the Michael Krasny Forum radio program this morning, could you help the Bay Area listening audience understand how NATO is not just Atlantic but also Pacific? I was in the Korean Peninsula this last spring and visited NATO training fields near the border of North South Korea in the village of Mugunri. And because the U.S. has such an extensive Seventh Fleet throughout the Pacific, there is a lot going on. U.S. troops are trained in Hawaii for service in Afghanistan. There's a major base in the Indian Ocean. The Pacific Islands, some of which are U.S. territories, Guam. Okinawa, Japan is a major issue right now, and the Marshall Islands for testing from Vandenberg. So I think those of us in California are directly involved. We have a great deal of numbers of troops that go from here and families that are affected. So could you speak to how the Afghanistan-Pakistan theater is influenced by troops and military from California?
Well, of course, I mean, the U.S. military has large global responsibilities. Afghanistan and Iraq, because that's where we have at the moment some 200,000+ troops directly deployed, supported by many tens of thousands more troops, affects any place in which the United States has military capability, of course, including on the West Coast. We have the largest Marine base in Pendleton down in San Diego. We have extraordinary capabilities on the Navy side, both in Washington State and down in Los Angeles, all of which are involved in one way or another in direct support of the military efforts that are ongoing in Afghanistan and Iraq. And in that sense, there is a direct NATO link. That's one part. I think the other part to understand is that NATO, while a regional alliance made up of North America and Europe, is acting in a global world. And the world is increasingly integrated and interconnected, and it is increasingly difficult to separate the Atlantic from the Pacific. I'll give you two examples. One is our four major allies in the Pacific area, Japan, Australia, New Zealand, and South Korea, are all four heavily involved and engaged in Afghanistan. In fact, the largest non-NATO troop contributor to Afghanistan is Australia with 1,500+ troops. The New Zealand is deploying hundreds of forces. South Korea has just deployed a major provisional reconstruction team in Afghanistan, and Japan is the second largest donor of assistance to Afghanistan. So our allies, and some of them are security partners, in fact, all of them are also directly contributing to a NATO operation in the Pacific. That's one area. The second area, which I remind my European friends, is that the western part of the United States and the western part of Canada is increasingly threatened by ballistic missiles coming perhaps from North Korea. A ballistic missile attack from North Korea on the United States or Canada is the same thing as a ballistic missile attack on Italy or Denmark coming from the Middle East. It is what we call an Article 5 event. Article 5 of the treaty says that an attack against one is an attack against all. The only time in history that it was invoked was when the United States was attacked on September 11, 2001. This is an Article 5 that was written in order to protect Germany, frankly, from a Russian attack or a Soviet attack in World War after World War II, and yet the newest way in which we can think about it is that there are threats that may well be as real to the United States in terms of terrorism, in terms of ballistic missiles, as it is to Europe. Which is all to say, we are in this together. This alliance is the means by which we protect our safeguard our security together. And that the threats can come from everywhere, which is why the West Coast is as much part of NATO these days as the East Coast.
Well, I think Poulsen-Hanson.
Just to add that in NATO we have traditionally had a discussion of what was inside NATO area and what was out of area, and that discussion doesn't exist anymore. With the operations in Afghanistan, in the Gulf of Aden, that would be if not unthinkable, at least it would be a subject for very heavy discussions in earlier phases of the alliance. So there's a recognition of the global reach and the global role, also because, as was said, that we have a strong interest in NATO from these countries, troop contributors, but also non-troop contributing countries. For instance, exemplified by the contacts that the alliance has to China?
Simply, this boils down to one simple issue. Inside NATO, we always said that our core business is security. Security of its member states that go from the Pacific to the Atlantic to the Mediterranean. Today, you cannot define security in terms of territory or geography. That's as simple as that.
So that raises a whole interesting area of discussion, which is as security threats have changed from the Soviets rolling across the Rhine with conventional forces to a new era of terrorism and cyber terrorism and so on, how is NATO changing as an institution to meet these new types of threats? Changing as an organization, changing in its strategy? Could you gentlemen comment about that? Ambassadors.
We all want to talk.
Yes.
that's a difficult question because a short answer would be not enough or not fast enough. I think NATO is being ready to recognize the changing nature of the security environment. We are being much slower in adapting our structure, which was built around static defense in Europe, basically, as for the thing you said, toward being capable of facing this range of threats, which is large, includes energy security, includes cyber attacks. I think we're getting there for one reason, like Secretary Gates said, a financial crisis is an opportunity not to waste. The combination that we have now of the operations, the demand of operations, especially Afghanistan, and the financial constraints will force us to make painful decisions and to reform and adapt. But this doesn't. When you don't have this sort of pressure, it is politically more expedient to postpone and keep going.
Ambassador Poulsen-Hanson.
I think this is also the reason why it was decided to look at the strategic concept of the alliance. The last strategic concept dates back to 1999 from the Washington anniversary summit. And as you may know, an expert group has been established under the leadership of Secretary Albright, and with a view to formulating a new strategic concept by the summit, which will be held in Lisbon in November this year. And in that concept, there will have to be an assessment of the new challenges and the new threats which you mentioned, which did not exist to the same extent 11 years ago, like cyber attack, like energy security, like climate change. And this will inevitably also lead to some considerations about the structures of the alliance. So the changes is not only in the at the conceptual level, but at least seen from our side, hopefully also in the organization as such, the way we are organized in Brussels, where there are still remnants of the Cold War headquarters, which it used to be, the way we have organized our command structure. Is that the best one, or is it too heavy and too unflexible to meet all these challenges? So the wish is certainly there to get to grips with these changes, and the opportunity, as I see it, is exactly the new strategic concept.
So let's take one particular area, and this is of key interest to the U.S. government at this point, which is cyber terrorism threats. What can NATO do about cyber terrorism threats against its members, and how is it approaching that challenge, if it is?
Well, since the issue of cyber threats and attacks is vivid for the alliance, and that at least one member some years ago was subject of one of those attacks, Estonia, NATO has taken this issue very seriously from at least that point on. In the first instance, from a defensive perspective, there is a realization that in the cyber world, your own vulnerability and security on the cyber side depends on the weakest link within your system. And our 28 countries are in important ways connected, so that strengthening the defense capacity against cyber attacks, not only in your own country, but in each of the 28 countries and of the NATO system as a whole, has been something that we have spent a lot of money and time and effort into, because the weakest link needs to be as secure as possible. So that's one, it's defense. How do you strengthen your capacity to defend against an attack? How resilient is your system if it is attacked to reconstitute itself? The very things that every company is doing, every government is doing, and in recent days and weeks, every country and company doing with increased urgency in order to deal with that. That's one. The second issue we're debating is if there is a cyber attack, which is becoming a means of potential warfare, cyber warfare, what kind of response should the alliance expect? Is this an armed attack, as Article 5 would define it? Well, that's one of the issues that the group of experts and then the nations will, in fact, decide. The difficulty you have with cyber is it's very difficult to find where it's coming from. So if you don't know where it's coming from, it's even more difficult to decide how to respond to it. Since the idea of Article 5 is not just about knowing that there is an attack, but actually to have a collective response to that attack, cyber poses an extraordinary challenge for a security organization like NATO, just as it poses an extraordinary challenge to a government like the United States. One final point is cyber networks tend to be owned by private businesses and are in private hands. So a government entity will have to have a collective response with the private sector. NATO, that's new territory for NATO, let's put it that way, and one that will be extremely challenging. And yet it is going to be extremely important that we address this, because the consequences of a successful cyber attack for the security of our country, of our countries and our populations can be severe.
So let's spend a moment on the NATO-Russian relationship. Ambassador Stefanini, you counted yourself among the Russia fan club. What do you see as the ideal relationship between NATO and Russia? I know Russia has proposed a new security treaty and a new U.S.-Russia-NATO treaty and so on. Do you see a major reformulation of the NATO-Russian relationship in the near future?
Not in the near future. When I mentioned the Russia fan club, what I mean is that we firmly believe that the best future for NATO and for Russia is in a partnership. When we talk about European security will never be complete, will never be secure, if you wish, unless there is a full cooperative involvement by Russia. That doesn't mean that we minimize the differences that exist with Russia. They're there. Certainly, the new approach by the Obama administration to missile defense has removed one major one, but of course, Georgia remains. We think that what divides Russia from the Atlantic community is much less than what unites in terms of common threats. Let's think about terrorism or narcotics. Russia suffered a lot from terrorism. We've been making some progress lately. We have to build on it, but it will be slow. As for the Russian proposals, they are not the idea of a new treaty, as it is formulated by the Russians, is clearly not acceptable because it would destroy some of the crucial things that we have. But there are some constructive proposals, as Secretary Clinton just said a couple of days ago. And mainly, I think it does express a serious Russia concern, which is being out, the one I was mentioning before, being out of the tent. So we should take it seriously, sit down at the table, and discuss it with them.
Ambassador Paulsen Hansen.
Thank you. I agree very much with Ambassador Stefanini's points. You mentioned from my CV that I had served in Moscow. It's now over 30 years ago. It was in the Soviet Union. But I sometimes have the feeling that the perception in some circles in Russia of NATO hasn't changed much over those years. And I think that's something we should take seriously. Also the fact that in the new military doctrine, which was presented some weeks ago in Moscow, number one of the dangers, as it is described to Russian security, is mentioned NATO and possible NATO activities, enlargement, military presence close to Russia's border. So I think there are a lot of misperceptions, which hopefully can be modified, changed, or eliminated through the NATO Russia Council.
A question at the mic. Ivo, did you have a comment before we get
to that? This is the most important relationship that NATO has with any of its partner countries, although it has many relationships with many other partner countries. It is an issue that in which the allies have different points of view. Our view is a very simple and very pragmatic one, which is we would like to engage Russia in cooperation on those areas in which our common interests are clearly at stake and in which we can have cooperative endeavors together. We have no illusions that this relationship is going to all of a sudden blossom into some form of large strategic alliance, but we do have a real desire to work with Russia on those areas where it's clear that our interests and their interests coincide. Afghanistan is a key example. The instability in Afghanistan has fundamental consequences for the security of Russia. We recognize that. Russia recognizes that. Cooperating in this area is important. We believe the same can be said of the proliferation of weapons of mass destruction in general and of ballistic missiles in particular. So we see missile defense cooperation as an area of extraordinary opportunity for Russia and NATO, Russia and the United States and NATO, to cooperate on. We believe the same is true with regard to the stability of Europe in the conventional arms, in the conventional field, something we are kind of deadlocked on and have not been able to work together. We would be interested in spending a serious dialogue on those issues. So we want to engage Russia in order to find ways to cooperate. The United States has engaged Russia. This is what the reset is all about, in order to find areas of cooperation. But we have to be pragmatic. It's not just about sitting together and having a good time. It's about finding those areas in which we can cooperate in order to achieve common effect.
Yes, sir.
The United States and most of Western Europe have incurred massive budget deficits to stave off another depression. Are the voters in your countries willing to stomach increased defense expenditures, including a missile shield in Romania, while taking unpopular measures such as raising the retirement age, laying off public employees, and cutting pensions?
Well, in the United States, that's an easy answer. The answer is yes. It's one of the few countries where defense spending remains a popular and largely supported area. That includes for the deployment of missile defenses.
I think it all depends on threat perception. In front of a real danger of proliferation, ballistic missiles and WMDs, no government would hesitate to spend what is necessary to build defenses.
I agree with that. But it is, of course, correct that the economic situation puts strain on all governments. And exactly, you have the political discussion about the prioritization, as you said, between defense expenditures, healthcare, education, etc. What we believe in Denmark, having also our percentage of the GDP has fallen, but what we believe is one way to maintain a strong defense contribution is to transform your military to the extent possible, adapt it to the new situation, and not be sort of dug into Cold War thinking. So looking at the output as much as looking at the input. And in our case, we managed in the last budget discussions to maintain the present level and even a temporary increase because of the extraordinary costs of having forces in Afghanistan.
Speaking of proliferation, what can NATO do about Iran, if anything?
NATO doesn't have a formal role in Iran. Although if Iran were to directly threaten NATO territory, then that becomes an issue for the alliance, which is where missile defense comes in. It is the Obama administration, looking at the evolving missile threat from Iran, concluded that one of the reasons we needed to change the way we operated our missile defense capability was to recognize that the short and medium range missile threat, particularly from Iran to Europe, was increasing at a more rapid rate than people had anticipated, and that indeed the longer-range threat, which had been the focus of the original missile defense deployment in Poland and the Czech Republic, was perhaps slowing down, at least compared to the short- and medium-range issue, which is why we proposed a new way of deploying missile defenses, which we also believed needed to be not about the protection of one or a few countries, but of all countries in NATO. That this is a commitment we ought to make to the entire alliance. With that regard, the deployment of a missile, the SM-3 missile in Romania, is not designed to defend just Romania. It is designed to defend Denmark and Italy and the forces of the United States in Europe as well. And indeed, the deployment of missiles in Poland would provide a capacity to defend all of NATO territory against this kind of threat. So Iran is an indirect, at the moment, issue. It is not yet, or it's not today, an issue in which we spend a lot of time as an alliance to deal with the issue, particularly the nuclear issue, which is being managed in a different form.
Eva mentioned the main thing that NATO can do. There are two other things that NATO could do. One is to work with our Gulf partners in providing and reassuring them and providing security, especially protecting the sea lanes for vital energy supplies. The other, which is little named, Iran has played so far a reasonably constructive role, at times very constructive, in Afghanistan. The region, region west, where it has the command, is on the border with Iran. There's a very strong Iranian presence, and so far it hasn't been a negative presence.
Ambassador?
No.
Just as security experts, aside from the role of NATO, where do you think we are with Iran, and what do you feel are productive steps we could take with regard to Iran's ever more clearly nuclear weapons aspirations?
Let me start out. The president, when he in his inaugural speech, said that he would like to extend a hand rather than a closed fist. He did to Iran. He has repeatedly said that he is willing to engage Iran at any time, in any place, and on any and on any subject. So far, that has not led to the kind of engagement that that we had hoped for. In the meantime, the nuclear program is continuing. I believe that the IAEA report of a few weeks ago, the International Atomic Energy Agency's report on the Iranian nuclear program, was deeply worrying and expressing a deep worry. One of the issues where the United States and Russia, for example, in the last year have made major progress is on this issue. Russia is now seeing the threat from Iran in the same way that the European Union countries and the United States have been seeing it, and are increasingly willing to take steps that are necessary to increase the pressure on Iran to end what, by UN mandate, it needs to end, which is the enrichment of uranium. So far, we see no steps by Iran to meet that UN Security Council requirement, and therefore, I believe that in the weeks ahead, we will see increased effort on the part of the United States and its partners in Europe and Russia and hopefully China to enhance the pressure on Iran so that it understands that the status quo is not acceptable.
I think that's your question, the $10 million question. The problem is that it's very hard for us to understand what makes the Iranian regime tick, not what, and what would have an effect on them. If, as you have to assume, that they're motivated like any other government, any other regime, also by the need of survival, the mix of pressure and open hand offered by the Obama administration has a potential to find where the desire of Iran to have a nuclear power for civilian purposes can be stopped at a level which is not threatening for us and for the rest of the world.
Ambassador?
Only to say that the I think the importance of having a kind of unified and united attitude by the international community seems to be key, as Ambassador Dolder mentioned, that hopefully the Russians and in the end also the Chinese will back up together with the U.S. and the European partners in the Security Council and elsewhere, and hopefully that unified front could increase the pressure on the Iranians in a way which will have an effect. We've been hoping that before, but I think we should continue to have that hope.
Speaking of extending a hand, it seems that there are an increasing number of trips and tours going from the U.S. to Iran. Some friends of mine are going on one in March with Stanford, and the Commonwealth Club is actually hosting one in May. And these are tourist trips. So it's becoming fairly common these days. So perhaps over time, the contact will be productive. The time has come after this very interesting discussion for just one last question. And someone from the audience would like you to discuss NATO's role in humanitarian actions. What is NATO doing in humanitarian assistance? What should it be doing? If you would comment on that.
Well, NATO has the largest aggregation of military capability in the world. So any place in which, for humanitarian reasons, there needs to be rapid action, bringing supplies, going to places that are difficult to reach, NATO can and in fact has had a role, whether it was in the tsunami where it sent bridging equipment in 2004, or indeed in the earthquake in Pakistan that Ambassador Paulson Hansen meant, when NATO helicopters were able to reach places that other places couldn't reach and provide very significant assistance. In Haiti, NATO played a much smaller role. In fact, NATO countries provided an aircraft capabilities to ship Danish assistance on Swedish owned aircraft that are part of a NATO consortium. So that's how NATO gets involved. But it's having the military capacity to bring humanitarian relief quickly and rapidly to places that are otherwise difficult to reach. Haiti happened to be next door to the United States, which made the U.S. military capacity overwhelmingly, and the Canadian in that sense, overwhelmingly the focus. But that is where the role is perhaps greatest.
I think in this area you should look at NATO's 911 if it is an emergency, because the reason that Ivo just said, NATO has some resources that can be used for humanitarian purposes.
Well, I think the planning ability of the still very big NATO staffs on a 24/7 basis, I think they come into very good function when things like this happen. And added to that, that there is kind of a clearinghouse coordination for the allies and other nations to report about their contributions and also to find out what is needed in a particular emergency situation.
Well, I would like to thank our distinguished panel today, Ambassador Ivo Dalder, the United States Permanent Representative to NATO, Ambassador Stefano Stefanini, Italy's permanent representative to NATO, and Ambassador Per Poulsen Hansen, Denmark's permanent representative to NATO. We also thank our audiences here on the radio, on television, and on the Internet. And we also wish to thank NATO for its assistance in arranging this program. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the Commonwealth Club, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, where you are always in the know, is adjourned.